Okay, so the lines are all muted. We're going to get started. For the speakers and for anybody that has a question, if you want to unmute your line, you need to press star pound on your phone, and we will remind you of that when as the call goes on. So go ahead.
Okay, we are going to begin. I'm going to ask Tracy to give a brief task update as we start out. Tracy?
Hi, everybody. Let's see. The Flex Conference is coming up this July in Portland, Maine. Registration is open on the website. We realize that there isn't an agenda up there. As soon as it goes through clearance at HRSA, we'll be able to put one up. If in the meantime you need something, like a draft agenda, to help with your travel arrangements, please feel free to email any of the task staff and we can send you a draft agenda. Other updates include you'll soon be receiving a mailing from task that will go out next week from our office that will include the 2011 update of the Flex Coordinator Manual. And that manual in its entirety will be available as separate pieces on our website too, so kind of an improvement this year with an electronic format. You'll also be receiving a booklet about the Rural Hospital Quality Leadership Summit that we convened this past December and that we've talked about on past calls and in emails to you. So look for those mailings coming soon. TASC is providing support to the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy and to the state Flex programs with the Medicare Beneficiary Quality Improvement Project. There's some resources available on the TASC website. If you just go onto our website and search MBQIP, you should find those resources. They're all housed kind of on one page. If you have any questions about that, you can contact either Paul Moore or Ron Knock at the federal office or contact any of the task staff. We thank you for those that responded to the request for information about your Flex programs working with your regional extension centers on health information technology. We're going to have a webinar on that on June 6th, that's a Monday. We sent out a call notice or a webinar notice for that. Those you do need to register for, so please send an email to Nicole Clement if you're interested in participating. And that will be from 2 until 3:30 Central Time, again on June 6th. And then the other thing to mention is a great opportunity for networks within your state to apply for a recently released grant from the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy on Rural HIT Network Developments. Those grant applications are due on May 27th. They held a technical assistance call yesterday that was recorded for playback. If you have any questions on the content or just some tips for developing HIT networks or sustainable networks, please feel free to contact either TASC or the National Rural Health Resource Center, as we were mentioned as resources within that grant.
And we've developed an HIT network readiness assessment that would be available. It's on the website now. So it's basically talks about what a network needs to think about as it's moving forward in terms of putting an HIT component into an existing network, for example, or if it's trying to add on to a network and take a focus on health information technology. As you know, there's a lot of resources on the HIT on our TASC website. Again, it's one of those things. Don't hesitate to call us if you get questions from potential network applicants and anything. You can either contact us directly or send them on to us. We're more than happy to talk to them as well. I also want to mention that we had a meeting of our Rural HIT Coalition, our national organization that many of you participated in. We do this at least twice in person at the National Rural Health Association's policy conference and then annual meeting as well. We are also planning an event associated with the Critical Access Hospital Conference, I believe in late September. So in essence, one of the things that we identified is an incredible amount of uncertainty in terms of really the reimbursement, which had seemed pretty straightforward. We've discovered is certainly less than that. We have Ralph Llewellyn today going to be talking about that. Chris Juliar talked for some time about the health information exchange and all of the uncertainties that are a part of that as well. It may seem pretty far downstream, but in some states the HIE is at the forefront of their agenda and kind of where critical access hospitals fit in, how this exchange of information is going to happen is kind of rife with uncertainties and just kind of an interesting, again, place marker perhaps for a later conversation as well. So again, just in the short of it is, we're really looking forward to seeing probably most of you in Portland, Maine this summer. I think we've got a really good agenda, as Tracy mentioned. And again, we invite you to let us know if there's anything we can do in the interim. And I think with that, I am going to turn things over to Steve Hirsch, who, at least I think for the moment, is still our project officer. Steve is going to tell you about a transition in leadership of project management of this program. And then maybe he, in turn, can hand off to Michelle Goodman, who's with us today, to talk about the critical access hospital regulatory changes and other policy matters. Steve, it's star pound to kind of log in.
Okay, I hope you can hear me now.
We can hear you, yes, thanks.
Okay, great. Yeah, this is Steve, and I'd like to welcome everybody to Task 90 call. Yes, well, I suppose most people have heard, but I'll go over the staff changes here at OHP, which are a little extensive. First, for me, I am changing my position at OHP and becoming the executive secretary of the National Advisory Committee on Rural Health and Human Services. Taking my place as the FLEX coordinator will be Mike McNeely, who I hope is probably on the line as well. Michelle Goodman, who you're going to hear from after me, is now the policy coordinator at OHP. Aran Nakhvi, who is one of the hospital state team and a project officer on FLEX state office and SHIP grants with some of the region E states, has become the rural health research coordinator. And since she's doing that and has left the hospital state team, Megan Meacham is now the project officer for the FLEX monitoring team. And I think I've covered everything except that Mike McNeely will also be the task project officer. So that's the news on OHP staffing. In other news from OHP, we now have a budget after a long, long wait, and all of our programs are still continuing under the current fiscal year budget. So you should have gotten the information about the SHIP grants. There was a call scheduled for now, actually, but it's been postponed till Friday. So watch your email for information about that call. It went out today for the time and the number to call into. There were some earmarks that were cut from the budget, but all of our programs are still in operation, so we're very happy with that. And I'll throw it to Michelle, I hope, at this point.
Hi, this is Michelle. I hope everybody can hear me. Terry?
I hear you.
Okay, just wanted to make sure. So I just wanted to give a quick update on some of the regulations that have come out in either proposed or final in the last few months. Two are of note, particularly for critical access hospitals, and the one is the inpatient prospective payment system regulation notice of proposed rulemaking that was just released on April 19th, even though it doesn't necessarily affect CA payments, but it did have some sections within that regulation that do affect CAs. So first off, the proposed inpatient hospital PPS, as I said, was published on the 19th of April, and comments are due June 20th. CMS is proposing to update acute care PPS hospital rates by 2.8%, what we call the market basket for inflation. Those hospitals that are not reporting quality measures would receive a 2% reduction in that market basket. And CMS has also proposed a 1.2% cut for productivity adjustment and a 1.1% required reduction under the Affordable Care Act. So with all of the different updates and adjustments that were made, overall, all hospitals will see a reduction in their payments by 0.5%, and for rural hospitals, it's a little bit more at 0.8%, negative 0.8%. CMS did propose to cut, to make an adjustment of negative 3.15% to remove effects of the increases in payments under the MSDRG system that are due to changes in hospital coding practices. So this is what's called the documentation and coding adjustment that you might have heard. So that was a cut of negative 3.15%. And Medicare-dependent hospitals and sole community hospitals will also see an adjustment this year of negative 0.25% for documentation and coding. Within that regulation, there were a number of additional measures that CMS is going to be proposing for the 2014-2015 quality reporting program and also for the hospital value-based purchasing program. In total, they are going to be proposing 56 measures in FY 2014 and a total of 73 for 2015. A list of all of those measures is at, you can find that in the regulation itself or also at the CMS website and the Hospital Compare website. The two things that were in that proposed rule that I think affect critical access hospitals in particular was, excuse me, there was a change to the CAW ambulance reimbursement services. So currently, if within the 35 miles of a critical access hospital, if there is a CAW-owned or operated entity or ambulance entity that is within those 35 miles and is the only provider of that service, then they receive 101% of reasonable cost for its ambulance services. If it was what CMS has decided to is proposing is to amend the regulation to say that if there is, after October 1st, 2011, if there is no provider or supplier of ambulance services located within the 35-mile drive of the CAW, but there is a CAW-owned and operated entity that is more than 35 miles drive from the CAW and is the only one within those, even if it's like 45 miles, but it's the only one, it's the closest one to that CAW, that they will be able to get the 101% of reasonable cost. If, say, there is another ambulance service provider that is outside of the 35, that is 40 miles away, and then there is a CAW-owned and operated entity that is 50 miles away, then they would all get the ambulance fee schedule. So I would recommend, if you're very interested in this, you can just let me know and I can see if I can provide some graphs that CMS had included in their inpatient regulation that I think really does provide a really good, clear graphics of what is going on. The other change that CMS is proposing to make is in the provider reimbursement manual, specifically in section 2118. Currently, for purposes of Medicare payments, CMS defines inpatient hospital services as being provided by the hospital as bed and board, nursing services and other related services, and other diagnostic or therapeutic items or services furnished either by the hospital or under arrangement, so under contract. What they are changing is for those situations in which certain routine services are provided under arrangement within the hospital, for example, such as contract nursing services, CMS believes that these services are provided in the hospital to its inpatients and consider these services as being provided by the hospital. If these services are provided outside of the hospital, then the services are considered being provided as under arrangement and not by the hospital, and then thus would not be allowed. So what they're saying is that the only things that can be provided outside of the hospital that are part of that are consistent with the statute would be those therapeutic and diagnostic services that can be provided under arrangement. So it's a little bit confusing, but I think that this is stemming from some hospitals that had been cited by survey and certification folks for having a contract nurse on staff. We think that this would take care of that issue because those contracted nursing services, if they're provided in the hospital within those hospital walls, then they would be considered part of the hospital and they would be allowed. That's a little confusing, but I think that that was a good fix. The other regulation that came out was, I'm not sure that most people saw this, but it was published on April 19th and comments are due by July 5th, and this is updating conditions of participation and conditions of coverage to Medicare-certified hospitals, CAHs, RHCs, FQHCs, and ESRD facilities for influenza vaccination standards. I know most of the CAHs and RHCs, FQHCs may be already doing, providing annual influenza vaccinations, but this is actually, this regulation would actually change the conditions of participation and conditions of coverage that would require these providers to offer all patients an annual influenza vaccination unless it's medically contradicted or unless the patient or patient representative or surrogate declines the vaccination. And it also would require these providers to develop policies and procedures that would allow them to offer vaccinations for pandemic influenza in the case of something of a influenza pandemic influenza event happening. Excuse me for my voice. I'm really bad allergies the last few days.
And Sal, can I ask a question while you catch your breath?
That would be great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. This is Catherine from Wisconsin. What you were just talking about before on the contracted services, am I to understand that they still do not want the ER services contracted for nurses, that only therapeutic and lab or whatever the other one you said are the only ones they're proposing to remove?
Well, what they're saying is for inpatient hospital services that are, which are considered bed and board, nursing services, and other related services. So I'm not sure if that would also cover the ER. I'm checking up on that one. That was a question that I had as well.
Okay, that's our biggest issue in our state is if, you know, if they can even use an occasional contracted nurse just to help with a maternity leave or an illness, not even necessarily on a long-term basis, although that would help too. We were told that not even on a temporary basis, not even for a day or an hour. And in the ER, that's a huge issue where that those contracted nurses really do, they're really needed.
I will check up on that and then give you a call back.
That'd be great.
And from what I understood, I think that this would take care of that, but, you know, the ER is separate, so let me check on that again.
Thank you.
Because when we saw that the first time, we were like, I think this helps. But we just wanted to, we'll make sure on this. The last regulation that I wanted to let you all know about was just published last week on May 5th, and it's the final telemedicine credentialing and privileging regulation that came out, and it would be effective July 5th. The final rule aims to reduce the burden of the traditional credentialing and privileging process for Medicare participating hospitals and for CAHs, both those that provide telemedicine services and those that are using the services. The rule extends the option of a streamlined credentialing and privileging process to those small hospitals and to CAHs that use telemedicine services of practitioners from distant site telemedicine entities, both from Medicare and non-Medicare participating hospital entities. So a hospital or a call that furnishes telemedicine services via an agreement with a distant hospital or a telemedicine entity can now rely upon information furnished by that distant hospital, which is oftentimes the larger medical center, or telemedicine entity when making credentialing and privileging decisions for the physician and practitioner at the distant site. And for those small hospitals and calls that feel that they lack the expertise possibly to perform the credentialing and privileging for the telemedicine services, so for those small hospitals and calls that feel that they don't have the information to the expertise to perform the credentialing and privileging, for the telemedicine services of specialized practitioners already privileged in a distant site, this should make the process a lot easier. We think that this, did go a long way. This regulation seemed to have gone a long way on making the whole process of the credentialing and privileging easier for folks. But please read that and let me know if you think that there were some issues with that final regulation as well. And I didn't go into. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
No. Go continue.
Okay. I just wanted to let you all know that we have pretty much staffed up our policy team in our office and have a number of folks that work on various different regulations and policy topical areas. So feel free to give me a call and I can guide your question. If you have questions or comments, I can guide you to the right person in our office that would be working on those issues. But just as an overall, I work on mostly of the hospital issues and I coordinate the responses to the regulatory Medicare and Medicaid regulatory comments that come through our office. We have Nicole Como, Aaron Fishbach, and Erica Molliver, who work almost full-time on our policy staff. Nicole does a lot of the post-acute care, and she's worked with the ACO and regulations, and she'll be working on exchanges. So if you have questions, she's a great person to talk to. And Aaron Fishbach is our clinicians and clinics person. So he works on RHCs, FQHCs, and the physician fee schedule.
Thank you, Michelle. I just want to add on that the credentialing issue has been huge for a lot of hospitals. They simply don't have the staff to go to all the work of credentialing. So this is really going to enable them to more effectively use telehealth and telemedicine. So that's good news.
Yeah, we thought that this was a pretty good win for small hospitals and for rural hospitals.
If you have other, we don't have any time to go into them now, but if you have other questions, why don't you email Michelle or anything that you can always pass them through TASC and we'll pass them on to Michelle as well. If you get responses, a lot of times the other Flex programs, I appreciate hearing about them as well. So let us know if we can help with that dissemination process too.
And let me just my email address for those folks who might not have it. It's mgoodman@hrsa.gov.
Thanks, Michelle. We really appreciate you being here
for
these calls. Okay, we've got our three different presentations, and they're all going to be about 20 minutes. We'd ask our presenters to kind of keep it to that amount, and also if they can, leave a little time for questions. The first one is going to report from the University of North Carolina, one of the members of our monitoring team, on some research that's been done. And I don't know about the rest of you, but I probably get more questions from critical access hospital leaders on financial issues than anything else. They kind of want to know, kind of what's working, how can we benchmark our financial performance, et cetera. And again, kind of the Maslow's hierarchy, when the finances are in turmoil or we're in crisis financially, it's hard for these hospitals to think about anything else. So today we've got Mark Holmes, and I believe George Pink is here as well, to talk about the report and the adoption and perceived effectiveness of financial improvement strategies in critical access hospitals. And before they speak, one of the things that we've really kind of promised ourselves is we're going to do everything we can to get this information, these reports out to our hospital leaders, and we'd ask all of you to think of ways to both distribute this information and find ways to get the hospitals to use it and to actually access this very outstanding resource we have available to them. So with that, Mark, I'm going to turn things over to you, and you'll tell us about your study.
Thanks, Terry, for that introduction, and we appreciate the help that you and TASC have always provided to us in getting the word out, as you say. So we should take less than 20 minutes. As academics, we usually try and take four times as much as we're allotted, but we'll be on budget today, I think. You should have gotten the attachment. This is on an article that is forthcoming in the Journal of Rural Health, but it is available on the website if you're a subscriber. It just hasn't been printed yet. And the context for this was, as you noticed in your guidance, in most recent guidance, you've probably been sensing an increased emphasis on evidence-based activity to improve operational and financial performance. And that's going along with increased emphasis on evidence-based activities and quality and other aspects as well. And so there's a movement by the office to try and focus the energies of the programs on things that we know work. Well, as Terry mentioned, there's not a lot of evidence on some of these aspects on what is it that actually works and what do we think works and what actually improves hospital performance. And so for one of the research projects for the Flex Monitoring team this year was to investigate this. And so the UNC side of the team, who tends to focus on finance, really developed pursuing a four-pronged strategy to increase this the evidence base on this. The first is a literature review that we've pretty much completed at this point. And as I mentioned, there's not a lot of literature out there that's been systematically done to show what can we do to improve performance. Including in that is a focus on state activities in these programs, and I'll talk about that a little bit more at the end of the presentation. A third aspect is a survey of hospitals that have tended to do really well, and some of you may know that we produce a financial indicator report on 21 different financial indicators for all critical access hospitals across the country, and we've developed benchmarks for five of these indicators. So we looked at these five benchmarks over the last 3 years and identified 32 hospitals that had met the benchmark for all five for the last 3 years. So of the 1,300 or so, 32 had met benchmark for those. And so George is leading an aspect on that to interview these hospitals and find out what is it that they're doing that has led to such great success. And he'll be talking about that, and just a plug, he'll be talking about that in July in Portland and some of the findings of those interviews, so stay tuned for that. And then the fourth aspect was what we're talking about today, and is a survey of critical access hospital administrators. And what we did for that is every August when we release the reports, there's a web-based interface that the administrators go to get their report and graphs and other ancillary materials that they use for the report. And every year we ask some very brief survey. And this year it was less brief, but we did ask them about 44 different financial and operational improvement strategies that we came up with talking to some practitioners in the field about things that people are trying or people think are trying or could be tried. We got 291 critical access hospitals administrators to answer this survey, and essentially we asked, for a given strategy, did you try it? And if you tried it, did it work, did it not work, or you don't know? So it's a pretty simple survey in that respect, but we asked about a broad number of strategies to try and get a sense about what's going on out there and what are people trying and what do administrators think is working, and that's probably suggestive of what they're talking about in different meetings to other administrators, and that, well, we had a problem with this, we did this, and it seemed to have made a difference. So of those 44 strategies, which focused on a wide range of activities such as human resources, revenue and costs, such as looking at the charge master, capital strategies, expanding your services, reducing your services, and then other activities as well, there were really nine that really popped to the top that seemed to be things that were being widely used and generally had a good report on them. And that is acquiring and replacing diagnostic equipment, holding down wage and salary increases, improving billing and coding training, and this is table 3 in the report, improving revenue cycle activities, joining a group purchasing organization, recruiting allied health personnel, recruiting primary care physicians, reducing amount of contract labor, and updating the charge master. And so those were the nine that tended to get the best assessment by the administrators. So with these nine in hand, and what we did is we took these 44 and put them into different buckets based on how widely they were being used and whether they were generally perceived as being successful or not. So of these nine, we're looking at them in more detail, and one of the things that we're going to be doing with some of these, not all of them, but conducting case studies to look at what are state programs doing in these areas. And so just as a refresher here, this is a survey of CAH administrators of what has worked in the hospital and what we're going to be doing in the creating a financial improvement catalog is going in more detail about what are state programs doing in this area. And we've talked with one or two different programs so far about things that they're doing in these areas, and we're talking with a couple others in the near future that we're just trying to find a schedule. But if some of these things are things that you as a program have done, we'd love to hear about it and find out more about what is it that you've done and any assessment that you have that's made it work. The idea here is that when a state program is filling out their application for the next year, and if they've got some data that says our hospitals tend to have trouble with primary care physicians and they just are really having a tough time finding primary care physicians for staffing, well, if you go to the catalog that we're developing and you can pull it up and you say, well, you know, Alaska had this great program where they did it, and here's what they did, and here's what's worked well, and contact them if you want more information. To really show, to try and put the spotlight on things that have worked and try and facilitate better information or more information sharing among the state programs. You know, as we've gone through this exercise, we found some really exciting stuff happening. Including there was a session that at the state program last year that TASC put forward, which had some real good leads and some real exciting stuff that's happening out there that we think is really important that everyone hear about. And those are the kind of things we're going to be putting in the catalog. So if you have, again, it's another call, but if you have been doing something in one of these nine aspects on a statewide basis, we'd love to hear about it, and we may become chasing after you if we find out from another source on things that there that are working. Alan, George, if there's anything else you want to add to that. Okay. He nods acquiescence. So I guess, Terry, I don't know if you want to take calls now or questions now or wait till the end, or I don't know how you want to do that.
Well, why don't we take – does anybody have any questions?
Yes, I have a question.
Yes.
Hi, it's Edwina here in Maine. The improved billing and coding training, Maine is in the process of developing a revenue cycle management education, and of the 20 eligible hospitals, 16 have signed on for it. But I'm working with Baker Newman and Noyes from Portland, and we are trying to develop an evaluation tool to evaluate impact. And I would love to talk to you about, well, obviously I need some help in how to develop that tool, but I was also curious, looking at table 3, among the respondents who reportedly tried strategies and the percentages who perceived good results, how do they assess that they had good impact from their billing and coding training?
So that's a great question. That's one of the weaknesses of this study is that it's a pretty crude measure. And so, for example, going to recruiting primary care physicians, well, that could be putting an ad in a paper, that could be having a huge signing bonus, that could be employing, that can mean a lot of different things. But it was a very, you know, crude question. This is essentially exactly the question that was asked. So it's the same thing for billing and coding. What does that mean? Does that mean a one-hour lunch session? Does that mean a three-day workshop where you get locked in a room and get subjected to all these different tricks of the trade? Just like we have a very gross measure of what the strategy was, we really don't know how they evaluated whether it made a difference. They were asked specifically about did it improve your finances, but again, that can mean lots of different things in how that worked, and it can be an administrator shrugged and said, yeah, I think things were better. That could also be something, denials were down and we increased our revenue for the same types of activities by 20%. So it's a wide range there. So I don't have any great solutions for you in developing the evaluation, but we'd love to chat with you more and help you think through some different ways that you could think about that.
That would be great because, yes, I'd like to persuade the other hospitals to become involved next year. But, yes, to be able to evaluate and show impact can only be good for the one in Maine and also for other people to learn from what we've done. So hopefully maybe I could call you and I could show you the evaluation method that we've come up with and we could discuss how we could improve that.
That'd be great. We should offline, we'll schedule something.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mark, this is Terry. You know, another question comes up. Let's take revenue cycle management. How sustainable is that over time? So, for example, we might get a consultant coming in from the outside. They help us with revenue cycle management, but after they leave, we go back to the same sort of methods that were there. And so I think the whole question of how you embed something like revenue cycle management in culture is one that would be important to think about as well. Is this a long-range gain or is it something that might dissipate over time?
Yeah, and I think that's an excellent point, and that's why our view of this was we really view this as something that as strategies that warrant further inspection. How about that?
Yeah.
As opposed to the holy grail of these are the nine things that will really work. So these are the things that we want to spend more time looking at. Whereas some of the ones that no one's really doing much in or those people who are doing stuff in it aren't really satisfied with the results, we're going to let those sit for a while and really try and focus more on the things that seem to be, at least out there in the field, have a wider belief of actually improving performance.
Mark, this is Dave Palm from Nebraska, and I was wondering if you broke down these improvement strategies by the size of the hospital, whether or not it's very low volume or sort of medium or larger, and whether or not that would make any difference.
You know, that's a great question, Dave. Table 2 gets into that a little bit, but we really thought that we'd see huge differences in the kinds of hospitals that are trying stuff or having success doing things. And there really wasn't. Our view of it and, the way that the findings or the results suggested to us and how we interpret them is that hospitals are trying lots of different stuff, and it's not just the big ones trying stuff. It's not, hospitals with these characteristics trying other, strategies other than mm-hmm. others. I mean, some of them are sort of obvious in that, for example, you really have to have a rural health clinic if you're going to do something in rural health type activities, or you can't expand, for example, if you can't expand into your OB services if you already have a whole bunch. You can't cut back if you're not doing it now. But other than that, it was a wide range, and there really was no pattern that we could perceive in how things pan out. I mean, for example, those with long-term care facilities were more likely to reduce their service or strategies that reduce their service offering. Mm-hmm. We tend to find that that's unsurprising because hospitals that have long-term care services tend to perform a little more poorly. And I think they know that, but they, the wisdom that, or the anecdotes we've heard is that they know that it's bad for business, but they're doing it as a service to their community. And so that's a struggle that they face. So that's a very long answer to, we looked at that and there's really no pattern that we could really see. George, if you have.
The larger hospitals were more likely to try human resource strategies.
So larger hospitals are more likely to try human resource strategies.
Well, that would make some sense, too. But, yeah, well, thanks. That's good to know.
Mark, this is Bendel Kemp. Just to follow up on that question and others, if we knew the characteristics of each of these 32 hospitals, I'm sure that it would probably vary because of the payment mix, in the Delta, you have very few commercial patients. So swing bed is a big part of their services. It might not be necessarily so in another area that would have more third-party payers. But if we had the, characteristics of these very successful hospitals, I think it would be helpful to others. And I know that they depend a lot on the outpatient department for services, for revenue. And do you think you could make a list like that?
We're currently finishing off our interviews with the CEOs of these hospitals. I will tell you that like the pattern that Mark just described, it's all over the map. There are geographically, there are hospitals in all parts of the country, places that I wouldn't have expected to find very successful hospitals. There are some there. There are some very large hospitals. There are some very small hospitals. There are some hospitals with lots of medical staff. There are some hospitals with only three or four medical staff, some with rural health clinics, some without. It's a real mixed bag. So we will be doing some statistical analysis to see if these 32, how they differ on basic things like we just mentioned. But I don't think we're going to find a lot of differences in the data.
The one thing that has tended to suggest is that it's a hospital, the Big Ten footprint tends to be overrepresented, if you will. Minnesota through Iowa, Nebraska, Ohio kind of region, those tend to have a little bit more of the of these high-performing hospitals. But as George mentioned, I think every region is represented. So
the only question, I'll give you a bit of a preview, the only question that I think I've had 100% agreement on is the importance of CEO and CFO tenure. The hospitals that have got a lot of turnover in CEOs and CFOs have a much more difficult time achieving financial success than hospitals that have got stable leadership.
And just to add to that, just a comment in that as we talk to accounting firms and folks that we respect, they're unanimous in their opinion that critical access hospitals tend to leave money on the table, either billing, coding, ineffective revenue cycle management, et cetera. And because as we look out, it doesn't look like there's going to be any more money for critical access hospitals. It strikes me this is just an absolutely excellent opportunity, to find money existing within their present revenue cycle and by more efficient financial management as such. So we also think that this idea of the catalog that you're talking about would be invaluable. It's just, and this is the stuff I can guarantee you that the hospitals really gravitate to as well. So do contact Mark or George. We'll continue to have dialogues with them as well. to, you know, how can we get this information out? How can we encourage hospitals to use the information? We know that there are states, quite a number of states, we've worked with a number of them in the South, for example, that have used financial workshops and coding and billing, et cetera, very, very successfully as well. So, you know, work with our monitoring team to identify some of these resources as well, and let's find out what's worked at the state level as well as at the hospital level. So with that, I'm going to move along. Thank you very much, Mark and George. Again, really exciting research, and we hope it continues into the future. I believe, is Ralph Llewellyn with us? If you are, it's...
Yes, I'm here.
Terrific. Ralph did a really excellent presentation for the Office of the National Coordinator. And there's a group, you know, a rural health group within ONC, and we got Ralph, who's with Ide Bailey, to talk a bit about what are the financial incentives, what are the variables related to critical access hospitals and the purchase of electronic health records, et cetera. And what we've discovered is that there's a lot of uncertainties out there, a lot of holes in the information itself. So we ask Ralph to be with us today and talk a bit about some of these issues. Ralph, I'll turn it to you.
Okay. Well, thank you. I think the biggest piece is exactly what Terry said, is that right now there are still probably more unknowns about this whole process than there are knowns. Having said that, I'm going to ask for some specific types of questions at the end of my session today, because I've been talking with some individuals from the MACs, the old fiscal intermediaries. It's my understanding that CMS is working on some scenarios, more scenarios to put out to provide guidance to the providers. We've been really pushing this for a long time, but they're in the process of doing that, and I've had one MAC who has asked me to come up with any specific questions or areas of confusion that we would like to have clarified. So I may not have some of those answers today, but it would be good information for me to be able to put together some feedback to them to hopefully get some better scenarios. A couple of things that I really do want to hit, though, because there's some real hot topic areas of sometimes confusion as well as just some real struggles. Home office issues would be one of them. A lot of the critical access hospitals that we deal with are part of a system. And what we're seeing right now is that several of these systems have set up their HIT, electronic health record, solutions through their home office, where a lot of the infrastructure and everything else is sitting in the home office. And Medicare and CMS are really taking a tough position on the allowability of that cost in the incentive. And here's the issue. For sure, the cost will be allowable through the cost report as they would have been in the past. The question is can we get them to qualify as being capital to the individual hospital? Because when you have a home office, costs basically flow through from the home office to the critical access hospital, including capital cost. It appears that CMS is going to limit the amount of capital that can be recognized from the incentive to only that capital that the home office can specifically identify. And we're talking by identifying it by serial number, you know, exact piece of equipment, and flowing that through down to the individual facility. That's going to severely limit, from what we've been seeing, any incentive payments for those facilities that have home offices. So if you got facilities you're dealing with from a home office perspective, definitely some things they want to look at as they develop the strategy of how they're going to get those costs into the incentives. We're also seeing a lot of issues in the area of leases. Medicare has come out saying that rentals will not be allowed in the incentive. So if you have an operating lease that's basically renting this asset for a period of time, that is not going to be an allowable expense for the incentive. Still be an allowable expense for the cost report, but not for the incentive purposes. There's a lot of confusion as to what is an operating lease versus what is a capital lease. And the vendors out there that are selling the products seem to be the areas of concern, because they're tailoring what they're calling a capital lease, putting it in front of the provider, saying, here's a capital lease, it'll qualify for capital on your on your financials, and you'll be able to claim it. The problem is that if you get your CPA firms, your auditors, to look at those, they're not meeting the requirements to be considered a capital lease. And we know that these types of arrangements are going to have a significant amount of scrutiny in the audit process from Medicare. So if you have providers that are looking at getting into capital leases of any sort, we really highly recommend that their financial auditors look at them, making sure that they're 75% of the economic life or 90% of the present value payments exceed the fair market value of the product, or there's a buyout option, a discounted $1 buyout, or the asset actually changes hands at the end. That is going to be really crucial. Again, just because the vendors are calling a lot of things capital leases that are not really meeting that. We are seeing a lot of activity in the area of financing. And really what we're seeing there are people just trying to struggle on how to get the financing on the front end to actually be able to get the asset so that they can actually get the incentive. Now, herein lies in some of the states an opportunity, because what we have found, and I've been working with a couple of vendors and groups of providers in a few of the states that have the Medicaid incentives already available. The Medicaid incentives, you don't have to have your asset up and running and be a meaningful user to get your first Medicaid dollars. And what we have seen in some states, mostly in the South right now, is that they've been able to access the Medicaid dollars. And for some of these facilities, we've heard some stories of some critical access hospitals getting some upfront lump payments of $1 million. And that's just their first year payment from the Medicaid component. They're still going to get the Medicare down the road, but it's that $1 million that's helping them get in into the game. So if you're in a state that's got a little heavier Medicaid utilization and the Medicaid programs are up and running, that's definitely a great avenue to be looking at how they can get into the game and make their financial commitments to get their EHR financing.
Hey, Ralph, this is Terry.
Yep.
We also heard at our coalition meeting last week that the requirements, which is 10% Medicaid patients, have been flexible in most states as well, and so that in essence that they were partial Medicaid payments or something of that nature. So there's been some good news out in terms of whether the hospitals actually qualify for these Medicaid patients, and it seems that in most cases they've been pretty flexible about it.
Absolutely. Some states are going specifically on days of Medicaid days. Some are, including the emergency room. So it varies by that. One area of confusion that has been out there that I've ran into is that the percentage that they use for the calculation for the 10% is not that's the calculation to get you qualified. It's not necessarily the same calculation you're going to have when you figure out what percentage of that $2 million base you get, because I've had some facilities that will meet the 10% Medicaid volume, but yet when you go to the Medicaid share calculation, which does truly use inpatient days, we've had 3, 4, 5% Medicaid shares. So there can be a big disconnect from that. So something to just kind of watch as people are looking at understanding that one number is to qualify, the other number is for the calculation, for the payment. The other area of real concern right now is hosted solutions. These are the ASP models, any type of subscription model where rather than purchasing the assets and bringing the EHR in-house, the vendor will provide a solution where for a monthly fee, you basically access their data center. Everything's housed, the software, all their equipment, everything, take care of the whole EHR solution. And for the most part, when you look at that, you're going to have very little capital expenditure. Capital that you're going to be able to put on your books and show as your capital asset. However, I've been on a couple of calls lately that are quite concerning in the area that there are vendors out there that have become extremely creative in how they tell the providers that they will model the agreement. And they're saying, well, we'll tell you how much of it's for equipment and all of these other parts. The problem is that there's no dedicated equipment. There's no serial numbers you're going to be able to tie it back to. Some of the discussions that I've heard, they're talking about burying maintenance in there, training. And when you're an accountant or working with CMS, anytime you hear the word burying, just shivers up and down. It's really scary what some of these providers are being led down. So if you got somebody who's looking at a hosted model, it's an area you really got to proceed with caution. For the most part, from what I have seen, probably one of the few things that would be a capital asset in that type of a transaction would actually be the purchase of the software. That software license that would be depreciated over the life of the software is really the biggest piece. A lot of the rest of the cost is not going to be something that they're going to actually be able to capitalize and get the incentive on it. Now, having said that, hosted solutions can be a solution for various providers. One of the things that, as we look at some of the hosted solutions, they may be cheaper than the initial outlay for a full system to bring in-house. The other thing is that if you've got providers that are in extremely remote areas that don't have access to the level of IT expertise in-house, these solutions tend to bring all of that to the table. But they really got to be careful to understand, is this just going to be a cost report cost, or is this going to be an incentive payment opportunity for the facility? One last piece that is really still a challenge for facilities are, you know, everyone's trying to set up their timing for meeting meaningful use so that they can get all of the depreciation of these assets included in the incentive. And that is going to create some real problems for facilities that do not have a September 30th year end. Because the way the cost report forms that are just coming out and with the CMS interpretation is that the way they're going to calculate the incentives at the end of the day when they finalize it on the cost report, it's going to be based on the undepreciated cost at the beginning of the cost report period that begins in the payment year that they became meaningful use. So if you were in this current year that we're in now, that'll take us through September 30th of 2011, and let's say you have a 6/30 year end. So your fiscal year is now coming up at the end of June. And if you were a facility who met meaningful use on January 1st of this year, the incentive would not have been calculated based on the undepreciated cost as of January 1st. The incentive will be based off of the undepreciated amount on July 1st of 2011. So facilities have to keep that in mind that their year ends are going to create them some problems. And we've really been trying to push CMS for some flexibility in there because it doesn't seem appropriate that facilities could be penalized based on the timing of their year end. If you're a September 30th year end, it isn't an issue because your beginning of your cost report period will match the payment year. And again, for some facilities, that could mean that they might miss out on a half a year's of depreciation for the incentive. That cost would still flow through the cost report, but a half a year depreciation, when you're looking at the difference between normal cost report reimbursement versus the incentive payments, that could still add up to be a fair amount of dollars. So just some things to watch and to counsel providers as they're looking to go down that path of implementation and trying to manage their timelines. So that's kind of the lion's share of the big things we've been seeing right now. And with that, Terry, I'd be open to some questions and any scenarios that anybody wants me to try to pose through CMS.
Are there questions for Ralph?
This is Mendel Kemp. Ralph, do you know of, has any hospitals received the incentive payment from Medicaid already?
Yes. I've been working with one vendor, helping them calculate some of the incentive numbers, and they've seen some payments, I believe, in Louisiana has got some payments going, and I've heard rumor that Texas had some payments that went out, and I believe Oklahoma has.
Okay, good. I'm glad. In Mississippi, we have 44 hospitals that have registered for the incentive payment through, for Medicaid, but only one has completed the attestation process. And that, of course, and they're planning on issuing the money after I think in July or August. But while ago you were talking about that, or Terry was talking about that, the Medicaid folks may be a little flexible on that 10% rule. Ours is not, and they're going strictly by 10% of discharges have to be Medicaid, and they have to meet that 10% deal every year that they participate.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not.
Yeah, and I think you're going to see a lot of variation in there, but it does appear from the different states that I've had to go out on their websites and look at that Terry's correct, that most states have adopted a flexible methodology.
We haven't.
Sorry, Mendel. It just and you guys could really use it, too.
Yeah, some of our folks are having a real problem with registering, even, because they have to get information from the 3 years, I think, previous cost reports. And a lot of times the data doesn't match up with what they have, and they have to go to CMS to try to get the right data, and they just go round and around. It's taken some folks over a month to actually register from when they start trying to. But anyway, that's our problem.
We're kind of running out of time. One of what we would encourage you to do, if you have specific questions, Ralph is an advisor to us, and what I'll tell you is that this is kind of of a specialty within critical access hospital financing. Not all of the accountants are really up on this. Just a couple of other names to throw out who are really good on this issue is Mike Bell, who has done a good bit of speaking on the West Coast. Tommy Barnhart has done some work with us as well. So just couple of other names that are out there. We would encourage you to, if you're doing anything, with your hospitals and HIT or in finance for that matter, to really look to this issue, try to get information out, part of what Ralph has expressed here, but that there's some precautionary things to think about as our critical access hospitals are moving towards meaningful use and purchasing electronic health records. And, it's going to be wise to be prepared for that, to maximize reimbursement, et cetera. And we'll continue to keep you updated on some of these issues. But I want to thank Ralph for being with us today. And, again, would invite you, if you've got questions about this, you certainly can channel them to us, and we in turn can, or to Ralph directly. But if you have questions for him, you can also channel them to us, and we'll pass them on to Ralph.
Terry, can I ask one quick question?
Yes, please? You may.
Can you meet, for Medicare, can you meet meaningful use criteria, stage one, if the state has not yet set up an HIE?
Boy, I'm not going to pretend to be the meaningful use criteria professional there. I've got some people I work with there. I have not kept up on all those individual components. My focus has been specifically on the dollars and cents.
Right. My understanding, Mendel, is that shouldn't be, in terms of reaching meaningful use, you've got to have the ability, and I'm just giving, again, I'm not an expert on this either, but you've got to have an ability to do your health information exchange, et cetera. But to my knowledge, there's no requirement that HIE be formally designated in some way as well. We will follow that up though, and we'll get back to you with that answer.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Thanks. Thanks again, Ralph. We're going to move on then to our final speaker, Cindy Dupree. Has done a terrific amount of work with critical access hospitals. She's kind of one of our favorite consultants. It has really kind of got into the depth of some of the financial issues that critical access hospitals face. She's from Draffin and Tucker, and I'm going to turn things over to her to talk about current critical access hospital financial challenges. Cindy?
I'm here. Thank you, Terry, very much. What I wanted to do is just give you an update of where we are in Georgia on the critical access hospitals, and I enjoyed hearing some of the comments about the benchmarking and the comparison, because those are some of the things that we had to deal with in Georgia. Over a three-year period, we did an in-depth fiscal analysis of 32 out of 34 of our critical access hospitals. They were two hospitals who elected not to participate, and the findings and the actual reports are published on the Georgia State Office of Rural Health website, and I was just going to give you all that website in case you did want to look at it, but it's www.dch.ga.gov, and that's DCH as in Department of Community Health, .ga.gov. And when we did this study, and I've talked around the country about this study, 27 out of the 32 hospitals we looked at had negative operating margins, and that was 84% of the Georgia critical access hospitals had those negative operating margins. And they were split, 50% of the critical access hospitals were owned or affiliated with another institution, and then the other 50% were operating as independent, mainly authority-owned critical access hospitals. The median operating margin was a negative 6.1%. And surprisingly, in Georgia, we have found, and also I've talked to some Alabama hospitals, that the hospitals that had the long-term care facilities, skilled nursing homes, were saying that this is what was saving the hospitals, that if it weren't for those nursing homes, and we have a different payment mechanism in Georgia on our nursing home reimbursement, that is what was actually keeping the hospital open, because the Georgia Medicaid program is cost-based up to a limit for the nursing home patients. So that was allowing these hospitals to spread a lot of fixed costs and overhead into the nursing home and share some staffing. So that was what was keeping them open. We wanted to look, because I heard Mendel talk about demographics, and we were talking about the 32 successful hospitals that were pointed out by Mark, and then the question was, are there some specific demographics? And we looked at that in Georgia when we got through with the study. And Georgia actually ranked in the bottom 10 performers in the nation in both operating and total margin. So we knew, there had to be some reasons as to why this was occurring. And we looked at things such as poverty. Georgia was number 13 in the nation with the highest poverty levels. So we ranked number 13 out of all the states. Georgia ranked number 3 in minority populations. And what we've, often seen is the minorities generally have poorer health status than some of the others. So we felt like that probably contributed to a lot of it. As far as health rankings, with 1 being the most healthy population, Georgia ranked number 43 in health rankings. So we, realize that the health status of our population is, is much worse than in other parts of the country. And we felt like that all of those type things were working against us, those demographics of the population we were seeing. And I'm sure Mendel in Mississippi, it's even worse. We looked at theirs, and I think Mississippi was one of the few states that were even worse than Georgia. So I know that all of that has got to contribute to the financial performance in our critical access hospitals. Another thing that was brought out in the previous presentation by Mark was turnover, that we feel like, and I think the results of our study pointed out, that turnover does negatively affect hospital performance. And in the last, when we did this study over a five-year period, there had been 50% turnover among the CEO and CFO positions in our critical access hospitals, and quite frankly, it's gotten worse since then. So we are seeing a lot of turnover, and we do feel strongly that is contributing to some of the financial performance problems that we're having. Some of the hospitals that were doing better had really strong swing bed programs, and I mean, to the point where swing beds may be 75 to 80% of their total patient populations they were seeing for inpatients. So we do have some that really have strong swing bed programs. They have been able to have specialty-type swing bed programs where they have been able to recruit therapists and have really strong rehab programs in their swing beds, and they've been able to have affiliations with nearby larger hospitals that would refer patients into those swing bed units for their rehab care. Now, just to give you a little bit of idea of how we're following up on this, when we looked and saw the turnover in our hospitals and the experience of the CEOs and CFOs that were being recruited in, which was not, you know, very long experience levels we were looking at, we realized that there was a need for education to our critical access hospital leadership. And when I say we, I'm talking about the Georgia State Office of Rural Health that's doing this. They had just contracted with our firm to perform this work for them. And the State Office of Rural Health realized that there was this vast need for education, so they did apply for a FLEX grant, which has been received. And now we have started, like I said, a very intense education program. We are right now in the midst of the month of May. During this month, we are holding 8 two-day workshops around the state in various locations. We picked different locations that would allow the critical access hospital personnel to be able to commute and not have to incur overnight cost of attending these workshops. We have already held 3, I'm leaving this afternoon to do another one. By the end of May, by May the 27th, we will have educated 33 out of the 34 critical access hospitals. These hospitals, 33, will have sent representatives. We are allowing up to 5 representatives from each critical access hospital. We have 150 people registered to attend these workshops. And as well as Georgia, we are also including the Alabama critical access hospitals and allowing these to attend these workshops. We have had great reviews so far. We have had attendance by board members, CEOs, CFOs, the patient financial service personnel. We've had medical records personnel. We have had nurses in the critical access hospitals, as well as clinical staff, such as respiratory therapy staff, et cetera. So we've really been excited that we have been able to get the attendance that we really wanted out of these programs. In addition to the two-day on-site workshops, we will also be having 6 follow-up one-hour webinars. We've already conducted one of those. We have another scheduled in June, and we'll finish those by the end of August. Just to give you some of the course material that we're teaching, we have a course on leadership, and we are using the Studer Group Leadership Principles. Studer Group has contributed 170 books to us to use in doing some of this leadership training. And we really wanted to focus on leadership to address the turnover that we are seeing in our critical access hospitals and to give some leadership tools so that maybe that can be addressed. We are also have a course we're addressing on charge capture because we have seen that lost charges have been an issue in our critical access hospitals. So we are going in depth on charge capture. We are talking about charge description masters and talking about the importance of those and why the coding is important, why it's important to have all of the items you're charging for in your CDM. We have a module that we're doing on cost reporting because that is how the critical access hospitals, Medicare payments, of course, are handled. And we want to make sure that all levels in the hospital, whether it's the CFO or if it's the medical record staff or the nursing or the clinical staff, that they understand the importance in their role on statistics and gathering data for the cost reporting. We have a module on accountable care organizations where we are reviewing the accountable care organization rules that were published on March 31st, and we're talking about the accountable care organizations, how they are going to work, and the critical access hospital's role and the physicians, primary care physicians' role in those. And we're also doing a segment on diversification, which is kind of going into what Mark was talking about, is what are critical access hospitals looking toward for different revenue sources, and we're covering rural health clinics, swing beds, physician practices, holding specialty clinics within their hospitals, the long-term care facilities, also respite care. We're trying to cover all those different revenue streams that we see critical access hospitals looking at and the things that they have to consider as far as staffing, capital needs, et cetera, market, community health needs, as far as that diversification goes. So we've got a pretty ambitious program. We have made it very basic. It's entitled Back to Basics. And so it is under a basic format that a board member or a clinical staff person could understand what we're talking about and the importance of their role in these facilities. Now, I heard somebody mention evaluation tools, how we were doing this. And since it is a flex grant, we did look at the SMART goals to and put some thought on how we can evaluate this. So what we're doing is before we teach each model, we are giving the participants a pre-test to see what their knowledge is of these concepts that we're teaching. And once we get through with the course, we give them a post-test to see if there has been improvement in their knowledge levels from what we've taught. And then 60 days after the course, we are also sending them a retention test. It'll be the same test that they have taken before, but we're sending that retention test to see if we can gauge then the level of retention that they've had. And as I said, we've gotten very good reviews thus far from the participants who have said that they are gaining knowledge and they really are appreciative of the state of Georgia and the State Office of Rural Health giving them the opportunity to come to these courses free of charge to them where they can enhance their skills. And so that's pretty much it, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Cindy, that's just a really terrific program. You know, we get the same sort of feedback from hospitals as we talk to them. We talk to them in focus groups, et cetera. So it's the turnover of top leadership, but it's also a mid-level manager issue as well, that in essence, as we know, people work their way up to management positions, and very often they have no experience, no background in budgeting, any kind of financial management as well. So the feedback we've gotten from a lot of hospital administrators is this is one of the most crucial areas of support needed, which is how can we train our folks, not to be financial gurus, but just to know the basics about finance, financial management, budgeting, et cetera. So that just, you know, we were particularly impressed with your program, and we'd suggest it to other FLEX programs as well. Any other questions for Cindy?
Terry, it's Edwina here. I'd just like to say, Cindy, it's really good to hear what you've been talking about because I have modeled, I'm here in Maine, I don't know whether Patricia's on the line, but I have modeled my revenue cycle management program from your Office of Rural Health, and I have used your information. So this is an example of where one FLEX program has learned from another. And we are also going to do a pre and post like you're doing. But obviously, that big financial analysis at the end we haven't got to that stage yet, possibly next year, but for the moment we're going to do the pre and post, and then maybe have some interviews with the financial staff at the hospital pre and post. But it's great to hear what you've been doing, and it's great to hear your outcomes, because we're really looking forward. We're starting ours now in September. We're using SHIP funds for it. So it's nice to hear your presentation. Thank you.
Great, thanks.
And we're going to hear a little bit more about this in Portland, and Patsy Whaley is going to be there and talk about the state program, this particular program, from a state flex program perspective as well. Any other questions for Cindy? Terrific. I want to just, I think we've got about a minute or two left. Since the topic of ACOs has come up several times, we had a somewhat lengthy discussion about this. We had our task advisory committee met earlier today, and John Suplett from the American Hospital Association, Brock Slabaugh from the National Rural Health Association, and then Ira Moskowitz is also a part of that group. And we talked about ACOs, and as you may know, I know we get a lot of questions about it, et cetera. As presently constituted, critical access hospitals are going to find it very, very difficult to fit in under these rules. And while we all acknowledge that that was going to be the case, and we aren't going to see a bunch of critical access hospitals coming out here, partially because of the numbers, you know, needing 5,000 covered lives, partially because of a lot of the other pieces to it, there was a strong recommendation from the group and the folks I just mentioned that the message to our critical access hospitals is that ACOs may not be, totally relevant for you right now, but all of the things they represent, which is coordination of care, kind of medical home models, efficiencies and lowering costs, et cetera, are all totally relevant for all of those hospitals. And we talk somewhat about how do we get that message out. ACOs may not be where you're going today, but it is imperative that hospitals really take, the principles that kind of underlie these ACOs and start to prepare for a time when they're going to be a valued participant in this sort of an arrangement. So we're going to work on that. We talked about trying to get some informational materials, communication aids, et cetera, on these sort of concepts, and we'll pass those on to you as soon as we acquire them or create them. Any other final questions for good of the order? I think we are exactly at half past the hour. And if there are no additional questions, I want to thank our speakers. I think this has been a particularly good discussion. So I really want to thank, Mark, Ralph, and Cindy, and George, as well as Michelle and Steve. We're going to say goodbye for now. Look forward to seeing you in Maine this summer. Bye-bye.
Hello?